You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm not.
Analytics don't work at all. They're just a crap to some people who were really smart made up to try to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a follower. He's a playmaker and a shot caller.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bowed. He shattered the mold. And all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538 Sports Podcast. I'm Chadwick Matlin, an editor at 538. Across the table from me, not wearing white after Labor Day. It's Neil Payne.
Never. Wouldn't dream of
Hello,
it.
Hello, Neil, sports writer at 538, also an editor at Times as well. And on the other line, coming from Bristol, Connecticut, HQ of HQs, it's Kate Fagan. Hello, Kate.
Hi, Chad. I thought you were going to give me a new introduction.
That's
Remember
right.
last week?
You know, it's
true. I thought
true.
You were going to come up with something super special, like I'm on your on-the-ground Connecticut reporter. I didn't know what you were going to come up with because you're so witty. And then next time.
You know, Kate, to be fair, I didn't call you an ESPNW columnist. And so I was really just abstaining from any titles because that's how magnificent. You know, you have all the titles, which means you need none. All right, on today's show, we're going to talk about NFL. We're just going to talk about football, actually.
Football.
College football, NFL, and then NFL fan free agency. We're going to...
Every darn type of football.
Except soccer.
Oh, that's true. All pigskin.
Wrong kind.
So, the summer's over. Football is here first. The NFL is imminent. We'll do a mini season preview by looking at the interesting quarterback storylines around the league, from the inexperience in Denver to the Lazarus in the making in Cleveland, and then to college football, where LSU and Oklahoma have already lost. ESPN Sharon Katz will come on to talk about a chaotic first week and how it affects the playoff picture. And then, after a week of anticipation, 538's Blythe Terrell will return to Hot Takedown to learn who her new favorite NFL team should be. Neil is going to tell her after running the numbers.
Nerve-wracking.
I know. So
Neil,
exciting.
Just give us a little tease. Were you surprised with the team?
Not really. Okay. No.
The Giants!
And then, of course, we'll close out the show with significant digits. Before we get to college football, one quick reminder. The U.S. Open is going on. That means our sister pod, our sibling pod, Baseline, is happening inside the Hot Takedown feed. It's Carl Bialik's peek inside the U.S. Open, which he interviews all sorts of smart tennis people and just chats about what's going on for you tennis nuts. So keep an eye out for Baseline and take a listen when you see it in the Hot Takedown feed. All right, on to football. One of my pet peeves of football coverage is when a journalist only talks about quarterbacks, because it's so easy to only talk about quarterbacks, and you know that's why a team wins or loses in the NFL.
Or the face of the team, Chad.
Exactly. And you know, you ignore all the other people who make a team win or lose. But here's the thing. We're about to just talk about quarterbacks because the quarterbacks are super interesting in the NFL this year. There are so
that
many
doesn't
talk
make
about...
it okay, Chad, that all of a sudden you've done that preamble, though.
Oh, just...
Does
no,
that, let, you,
it's a bait
does
and
that
switch.
Let us off the hook?
Well, it's a pivot. You know, that's
okay,
what
good.
In journalism we would call sort of... You acknowledge the weakness of your argument, and then you move on.
Yeah, you're kind of anticipating.
Ideally, without anyone calling you out on it. So let's start with the Broncos, who released Mark Sanchez and chose to stick with two quarterbacks who have never thrown a pass in the NFL. Here's ESPN's Max Kellerman on what that might mean for the team.
So they go into this season with two quarterbacks, Simeon and Paxton Lynch, who've never thrown an NFL pass, in a real NFL pass, in a regular season game. And that does not bode well for the Broncos this season, even though they did well enough with two quarterbacks who offered them very little last year, other than Peyton Manning's brain. But obviously, physically, he was done.
So talk about arguments that turn back in on
right.
themselves.
Right.
He says at the end there that maybe actually these two guys might be better than the two that the Broncos used last season. Neil, you wrote about this a little bit this week. So is Simeon going to be that bad, given what the Broncos have come from?
Well, he will be historically inexperienced for a team starting for a player starting for the team that won the Super Bowl the previous year. I went back and I looked, and I found only one other case where the starting quarterback in week one for a team that had just won the Super Bowl also had zero career starts and zero career approximate value, which is this way of measuring a player's kind of career value. And the only other time was another Broncos team, and it was Brian Greasy in 1999. He followed up for John Elway, another Hall of Fame quarterback like Peyton Manning. And he ended up actually having a pretty good season that year. And so, you know, the average quarterback who has so little experience and so little career value under their belt as a week one starter isn't good by any stretch of the imagination. But the thing is, the like Kellerman alluded to, the Broncos got very poor performance. Peyton Manning was literally the worst quarterback we even talked about on the show, the worst Super Bowl quarterback in terms of regular season performance ever a year ago. So on the one hand, yeah, Trevor Siemian is not very experienced, but then on the other hand, it would be hard for him to perform worse.
Neil, I'm going to take this big picture for a quick second, because Neil, I want your take on something. There's the 30 for 30 short doc about the great trade robbery, the Herschel Walker deal.
Right.
And in it, the Minnesota Vikings GM, the guy who traded for running back Herschel Walker, has this quote in it. And that trade is right, like, in early 90s, right? End of the 80s, early 90s, mm-hmm. when that trade is made. And the Minnesota Vikings GM says, like, concretely, you need a running back if you want to win a Super Bowl in this league. It was like running backs equaled Super Bowls. And it was so blatantly obvious, the comparison, that now we treat quarterbacks the same way they treated running backs in the 80s and 90s. Now we're coming upon, what is it, 27, 28 years since that trade. And here we are talking about quarterbacks and how, and the Broncos and Siemian, and clearly leaning on a different part of the game and not the quarterback, which is totally going against the NFL grain. Do you think in any way, or in here I am putting you on the spot, in any of the stats you've seen, that there is a possibility that the Broncos are onto something, that maybe people now are so leaning heavily and overvaluing the QB that there could be an opening in how to win in the NFL?
Well, the Broncos already won with a quarterback that wasn't that good, so maybe there's some evidence there. That
yeah,
the trick,
but
this,
there's the one-off, right, of like the Baltimore Ravens, great D, and now the Broncos, right, great D. And then there's a capitalizing on people over-leaning toward one style.
The trick this time is they're spending much less money on,
right,
a quarterback that might be as bad or better than
as effective,
that,
maybe,
and therefore can put that money elsewhere towards the team. You saw that in the offseason with the way that they spread their money around. And so perhaps, and our colleague Ben Morris talks about this all the time, that we talk about the NFL in the way of sort of the talent level at each position without taking into account how the money spent on different sides of the ball affect other positions and how, mm-hmm, you fill them. And so it,
right,
could be, Kate, to your point, that if you spend no money on the quarterback, then all of a sudden you can make sure you retain your championship defense.
Well, I would say two things here. First of all, that, you know, that trade for Herschel Walker and the quote about needing a running back to win in the league was really a case of not having foresight and kind of bad timing about the direction in which the league was heading, because that may have actually been true in the 70s in certain cases. Like the running game was so important at that time that having like an Earl Campbell or, you know, a Franco Harris or someone like that actually did sort of could be the cornerstone of your team, and you could sort of just put all your eggs in that rushing basket. But then, you know, as you go forward, the evolution of the game since then has clearly been in the direction of passing, to the point that, you know, even if quarterbacks are overvalued, trying to figure out a way to improve the passing game itself, and maybe that's by, you know, having receivers that are known to kind of have a track record of improving passer performance, and maybe more than investing in quarterbacks or maybe investing in a, you know, a left tackle was the classic Michael Lewis, you know, blindside argument. Just anything you can do to improve the passing game, though, has kind of proven to be the kind of one of the more important things that you can do to make your team better as a whole. The other thing I would say about the idea of, you know, which side of the ball do you build around? The Broncos have kind of said, okay, look, we didn't have that much quarterback performance last year, and we still won because we had this historically great defense, one of the all-time great defenses if you look statistically. I think one of the problems with that line of thinking, if there is a problem with it, of building from the defense, is that defense has proven to be kind of tough to predict from year to year. Even if you have a historically great defense one year, it's probably going to regress to the mean between years because defenses are less consistent, and maybe it's because they have more moving parts. Maybe, you know, an offense, especially the passing offense, it's more consistent because you do have that fulcrum of the quarterback. And so as long as that one person is still there, as long as Tom Brady is still at the helm of the Patriots, for instance, or Peyton Manning with the Colts and then the Broncos, you can put different parts around him and still have be confident in how good of an offense you can build. But if you're building around a defense, it might be more difficult to, you know, kind of have something that you can rely on and be able to comfortably build to the point that you can say, oh, we don't need to worry as much about quarterback. This is a transition year there, but we'll rely on our defense to win. And I think if the Broncos fall into kind of a funk this season, it'll probably be because their defense comes back to earth a little bit, just because no defense can maintain that level of performance.
All right, let's move on to Cleveland, where Robert Griffin III is attempting a comeback that...
Don't call it a comeback, Chad. Okay, you can call it a comeback.
Neil, I don't think I've ever seen you make yourself laugh quite as much as that one just did. Neil, Neil and Kate, this seems like a situation ripe for a media narrative in which, you know, not just does Robert Griffin III make a comeback, but so do the Cleveland Browns. And you know, you have this sort of redemption narrative that is tailor-made that ignores whatever weird thing happened to Robert Griffin III. And Neil, I'm wondering if you can put some numbers to, like, just how good he was during that rookie season and how bad he was after Shanahan continued to force him to play even when he was clearly hobbling around in that playoff game.
And let's not forget the added narrative that Cleveland is now a championship city.
That's right.
Yes.
In addition to
RG3's
redemption.
Is RG3 the LeBron of the NFL?
That pressure is totally...
Except without the home narrative.
Yeah, the pressure is totally off of them, so they don't have to worry about that. Mm-hmm. You know, to talk about how good he was, if you look at approximate value again, which is kind of a rough gauge of how well a player played, I looked at this 2 years ago when I was kind of trying to figure out if he could repeat the performance that he had in 2012, and only 35 quarterback seasons since 1950 were better than his 2012 season.
So another way to put that is he had one of the 40 best quarterback seasons ever.
Of all time. Yeah, that season. And so in some ways it was going to be tough for him to replicate it at all anyway. And so maybe, you know, being that successful that early in your career could kind of set you up for disappointment. But also if you run kind of a similarity index on seasons like that at that age, you end up with a lot of like great quarterbacks. You got Russell Wilson, two of his seasons, a Tom Brady, a Drew Brees, Ben Roethlisberger. You also have Mike Vick, Steve McNair, Jim McMahon, Dave Craig. So, you know, you have some at worst pretty decent quarterbacks and at best Hall of Famers.
Like off the top of my head, it doesn't seem like great quarterback seasons are one hit wonders, right? Like when you name the top 40 QB seasons of all time, I would assume that there would be a ton of repeats. How many like solo sort of great performances stand out, flash in the pan to QB seasons like fill that top 40?
Yeah, I think that that's probably true for the most part. I mean, if you look at guys like Peyton Manning show up a lot, Steve Young, Kurt Warner might be somebody that only has like a few entries on the list, but, you know, Dan Marino, I think of Burt Jones in 1976 as somebody that, I mean,
oh,
haven't
Jones,
we all?
That's right.
That was a case of a quarterback having a great year and then just getting hurt and never being at the same level. So there are some guys that, you know, some players who have, you know, astronomically great seasons. If you kind of lower the threshold for attempt, Nick Foles from 2013 shows up. He had one of the great passer rating seasons of all time, and I don't think anyone would consider him sort of in that same group. He hasn't played like it since. So it's definitely possible to have one-hit wonders, but I would say the majority of the best passing seasons of all time are your Peyton Mannings, your Aaron Rodgers, your Tom Brady's, and
so forth.
So
I guess this gets at sort of what Kate was getting at, which is like, how crazy would it be for RG3 to somehow come back even to middle of the pack status as a QB? Because what I'm trying to figure out is whether having a season as good as the season he had is an indicator of talent, that he would regress back at
right,
least closer
right.
to that,
it's
talent.
Inside of him.
Yeah, however, we have more seasons that suggest otherwise. Now, he was in a weird system in Washington that didn't seem to accommodate his talent. There was lots of history, obviously, within the
But before that, I mean, I think he was one of the first group in that wave of kind of pistol offense,
right.
read option quarterbacks that really defenses were not prepared for at that time, but I think they've gotten a lot more
prepared. He may have been exploiting a marketing efficiency, basically.
Possibly so.
Yeah.
And I would say, you know, as much as we say that, you know, the people that have those great seasons are usually great quarterbacks, I would say that by the same token, if you flip it around, there aren't many great quarterbacks who kind of have those seasons, but then also have seasons that kind of have been as mediocre as RG3 has been since, and especially having kind of, like you said, Chad, mediocre seasons outweighing the great season. And it's difficult to think of anyone who was at that level, then sort of fell off of that level, whether due to injury or just kind of underperformance, and then regained it again. Dante Culpepper would be somebody that, you know, was great, fell off, never the same again. I would say the biggest example that comes to mind of someone that did eventually recover, and maybe this is the path that RG3 could try to emulate, although I would caution that it's probably pretty unlikely, is Randall Cunningham. Randall Cunningham in the early 90s had some of the great all-time sort of passing rushing combination seasons, which were incredibly valuable as a quarterback. And then he was out of football within, you know, 5 years of that, and he ended up coming back with the 1998 Vikings and having another one of the greatest quarterback seasons of all time. He and Kurt Warner probably were two of the only players in NFL history who had two of the best quarterback seasons of all time for two different teams, like 5 or 6 years apart. And that is very rare, and it remains to be seen if RG3 is in that group or if he's in kind of the Nick Foles, Dante Culpepper, you know, were good but then sort of lost it group.
So let's speed through one last quarterback because it's too interesting to totally ignore, which is the Sam Bradford trade to Minnesota to replace Teddy Bridgewater, who went down with a non-contact, I believe, ACL or something.
Yeah, it was like a total destruction of his knee.
And so all of a sudden, Minnesota, who had looked as though they had really found the blueprint, is left scrambling. Neil and Kate, it seems to me like the Vikings are trying to salvage an unsalvageable ship for the season.
Neil,
like, why even make the trade?
Yeah, Neil, let me put the question to you and try and address it from an analytical point of view. Like, the knee-jerk reaction to
no pun intended.
Oh, boy.
Oh, man. Seriously, no pun intended.
Yeah.
To paying a first-round draft pick in 2017 and the fourth-round draft pick to get Sam Bradford seems like too high of a price to pay. But then the opposing viewpoint is that the Minnesota Vikings kind of seem primed and they're aging and they seem primed to be good this year. And so taking a gamble for the cost of a first round draft pick is what they needed to do for this coming season. I wonder if there's any way to like analytically weigh the cost of that first round draft pick versus Sam Bradford.
You can kind of look at the past production, and again, I'm going to come back to approximate value, which is apparently my favorite metric, but it's a super useful metric for kind of
Ken Palm of the NFL season.
It kind of is. It's from Pro Football Reference. You should check it out if you haven't already, but it tries to kind of put a rough value number on players across multiple different positions, and so you can kind of say, oh, okay, how valuable was this linebacker versus this quarterback versus this running back, etc. And again, it's very approximate, as you can tell from the name, but if you kind of do it in aggregate for all of the players who are drafted at a given slot, you can kind of say, okay, how much is a draft pick worth according to this? And if you look at the kind of return that Sam Bradford could be expected to provide, you could estimate that he probably has about 40 points of approximate value left in his career. He was 28 last year. He has not had a super great track record as a quarterback so far in the league, very injury prone and kind of mediocre when he has played. And so a first round pick alone could be worth as much as 70 career AV, probably on average more like 50. So they're already kind of behind on that. And then a fourth rounder tacks on somewhere between 15 and 20 AV. So they're giving up a huge amount just in terms of okay, if you're making this sort of simple calculation of value in, value out, they're giving up too much. And the only argument for it is what you said, Kate, where, you know, if you're trying to strike while the iron is hot on a roster in a situation where you think that, you know, this might be the opportunity, then maybe it could be defensible. Certainly Bridgewater wasn't expected to give you that much more than Bradford would be this season. But the only problem there is that I think, you know, you have to wonder if Minnesota was sort of looking at last year and kind of trying to build off of this, the landscape of last year, and that maybe they're kind of not looking forward. Mm-hmm. And certainly they're not looking forward when it comes to the long-term value of the draft picks that they gave up.
Okay, let's leave it there with the quarterbacks and just talk really quickly about who 538's ELO forecast believes is going to win the Super Bowl. This is a sneak preview. These numbers have never been reported before. This is part of a simulation that will go up on the site later this week. So check out 538.com for the full Super Bowl probabilities. All right, guys, if you had to guess who's got the highest Super Bowl odds according to ELO, Neil, you already know. So, Kate, who would you say?
The Patriots.
The Patriots are in sixth on the
sixth.
They have a 7% Super Bowl probability.
Now, we should also say this doesn't actually take into account the loss of Tom Brady for the four games. So I think it would be a little more impressive if it did. But I think that probably mentally we can kind of say that their odds should be even lower.
So Denver, which granted does not take into account everything we just talked about, the quarterbacks. Just take into account sort of regression after the season.
Right, and strength of schedule
coming up. Yeah.
In 2016.
11% chance of winning the Super Bowl, 74% chance of being the playoffs. So it goes Denver, Seattle, Carolina, Kansas City, Arizona, New England.
Oh, Kansas City, that's so adorable.
We should mention the Giants for Kate.
Yes.
Neil, do you want to break the news?
So the Giants right now, according to ELO, have a 1% chance of winning
the
Super
Bowl. That's just lying. That's a lying statistic.
Too high, too low?
It's too low. It's a liar.
32% chance to make the playoffs. And anything can happen when you make the playoffs, Kate. So.
The Giants have proven that. So.
And we should also say that ELO at the beginning of the season, like you said, Chad, could be a liar in some ways, because it does just take the rating that each team had at the end of last season and kind of regresses it to the mean. And so teams like Denver, Carolina, Seattle, and Kansas City, those are the top four by ELO. They also, you know, didn't grade very well in the offseason according to some of the major media outlets, and people like Bill Barnwell kind of looked at offseason grades. And so it could be, you know, Kansas City's saving grace, and to a lesser extent Denver would be an easy strength of schedule. They have, you know, easier strengths of schedule. Seattle, not so much. So, you know, you could see the Giants have the seventh easiest schedule, and they also had the sixth best offseason if you look at a composite of people that kind of judge offseason. So probably ELO is underrating the Giants right now.
Look at that,
now, does that mean that they will make the Super Bowl? Probably not.
Neil, you should have ended on the high note. You didn't need to go back there.
All right, let's end before Neil aggravates Kate any further.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to come back to football, the NFL, that is, later in the show. First, a word from our sponsor, and then we're going to come back after the sponsor with more football, this time college football. Hot Takedown this week is sponsored by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings the mortgage process into the 21st century. That is the century that you are living through at this very moment. Forget about digging through stacks of paperwork. Rocket Mortgage is a completely online process that lets you safely share your bank statements and pay stubs with the touch of a button. Using your phone or tablet, you can get approved for purchase or refinancing in just a few minutes. Get a custom mortgage solution at your own pace, whenever and wherever you want. So if you're looking to refinance or buy a home, check out Rocket Mortgage today at quickenloans.com/takedown. Rocket Mortgage is an equal housing lender. It's licensed in all 50 states and NMLS consumeraccess.org number 3030. All right, college football has returned, and it was a crazy first weekend. Houston beat number 3 Oklahoma. Wisconsin, unranked Wisconsin, beat number 5 LSU. An unranked Texas team beat number 10 Notre Dame. There were some other close misses. There was a field goal that didn't get to the field goal, and it was run back in that Houston game that was thrilling to watch.
FSU trailed Ole Miss 28-6 at one point.
That, too. With us to talk about all this craziness is Sharon Katz from ESPN Stats and Info. Hello, Sharon.
Hello.
All right, Sharon, make sense of that first weekend for us. Were you as surprised as I, the casual fan, was?
Well, I mean, it was branded as the best kickoff weekend ever, and it definitely lived up to the hype. I mean, I knew there was going to be some upsets. It's just a matter of which ones. I think Houston was definitely surprising over Oklahoma, but it had everything. You mentioned it, the comebacks, the upsets. We had our biggest FPI upset in the last 5 years when South Alabama beat Mississippi State.
That's the football power index that Stats Info keeps. That what does the FPI take into account?
How past performance, returning starters, recruiting, but mostly past performance.
Okay. And so, sorry, the biggest upset in how long?
The last 5 seasons.
Wow. Okay.
So Sharon, I know everyone was talking about how it was possibly or maybe confirmed the best weekend ever in terms of like matchups. Does that mean that we're going to see a stronger slate of games throughout the year, the teams are scheduling better, or was it just an anomaly that there happened to be some strong first week games and we're going to still have a bunch of duds going forward?
Well, week two is definitely a letdown after this one, but there's some other good non-conference games. In week three, you have Ohio State and Oklahoma. The end of the year always has the good SEC-ACC matchups, which you have every year. I think this year was a little bit of an anomaly in terms of how great this week one was. There are some good matchups next year, but everything just kind of fell into place for this week one.
So, Sharon, I want to talk about that, about the playoff picture, and really use that Houston game as our way in. And so let's just take a listen to this take real quick about that Houston win. This is from Doug Kazarian from the Championship Drive podcast, explaining why that just one win from Houston means really good things for the playoff chances.
I love their chances because what the college football playoff has done, it is increased the value of the eye test. And I think the eye test, they pass. This wasn't Wisconsin beating LSU in a slugfest with just kind of Big Ten play. They looked every bit as a strong Power 5 team. The speed popped off the screen. Greg Ward looked good. And it's, let's be honest, whether people want to admit it or not, last year is a factor.
Yes.
And last year they looked every bit the part as well, beating Florida State in the bowl game.
So Sharon and Neil and Kate, there were lots of sort of allegations made there about how the playoff committee selects, the eye test being more important, last year being important. Does that strike you, Sharon, as a very close watcher of this, as accurate, that the committee is placing value on these unscientific measures?
Just based on what we've seen the first 2 years, it's actually more, they're putting more emphasis on a team's resume and accomplishment, I think, than the eye test. The eye test, I feel like they're using to break ties. But we have two different metrics at ESPN Stats and Info, and one's an accomplishment rating called strength of record, and the other is your typical power rating, which that's more of what you think of with the eye test and the best teams. And in the first 2 years, the teams to make the playoff were the top four teams in strength of record last year and three of the top four the year before. So they seem to be going more with accomplishment. The question is, if Houston wins out, will their record be deserving of making the playoffs?
Now, Sharon, is that kind of a break from the tradition of college football, or is that kind of in keeping with the way that they've always done it, where if Houston goes undefeated and kind of runs the table, even if they don't have a very strong strength of schedule, especially with a four-team playoff, would it be sort of in keeping with the way college football has been to kind of slot them into the playoff now that there's that extra two spaces compared to the BCS era?
Houston's an interesting case because, unlike some of the other teams, the group of five teams that made a case in the BCS era, Houston has two really hard non-conference games. Oklahoma game, which we talked about, and then they play Louisville the end of November, and Louisville looks like a pretty good team. So whether that's going to be enough to get them in the top four, our numbers say that if they win out, that would be enough to have a case for the top four. But winning out in college football isn't very easy, even if you're clearly the best team in your conference, it's still hard to go undefeated.
Right, because it seems like part of the allure of college football is, of course, that the stakes are sky high, and that's kind of what college football has traded on always. And the four-team playoff continues the do-or-die nature every single week, which kind of draws in the casual fan. And I'm wondering, and this could be a question more so for Neil, maybe if he's crunched the numbers. I mean, even though this is only like the beginning of the 14 playoff, of course the question is out there about what the sweet spot might be toward keeping the stakes really high, but also making sure that you're getting the best national champion or the fairest or whatever, however you want to describe, like getting a national champion that you truly believe was the national champion. Like, is there a way to analyze whether or not four is the right number?
Well, one time I did a thing at Football Perspective, which is Chase Stewart's site, where I assigned each team a sort of, if we were omniscient and we knew the talent level of each team, give them a power rating and then simulate through the season and also simulate the selection process for a bunch of different playoff size types from 2 through, I want to say, 16 teams, and then figure out which of those formats gives you the most talented team the most often. And when I did that, the 10-team playoff actually was the best. If you do that, it gives you like marginally higher chance of getting the best team into the playoff and having them win the playoff, but really, even like the BCS model isn't that much worse, and the 4-team playoff is not that much of an improvement, nor is it that much worse than the 8 or 10-team playoff.
But it would hold true that if it was 10-team, then the Colorado Buffaloes, who defeated CSU 44-7 on Friday, would probably more likely, possibly even definitely, make that 10-team playoff this year, don't you think, Neil? I mean, because they looked so good.
Well, Sharon, what do the numbers say about Colorado's chances of winning out?
Yes, let's go completely homer here in my alma mater. Do you expect the Colorado Buffaloes to make the 4-team playoff, Sharon?
I can say it is not 0%.
Wow.
Thank you.
Okay.
That's a very
538
answer. So can we talk about the SEC just for a second, since they are basically a league?
Because people, no one ever talks about them.
No,
well, I'm just saying.
Love.
Excuse
Let's
me.
Let's throw the SEC
oh,
a bone,
my
everybody.
Gosh, we barely ever talk about college football. Now I'm trying to talk about the thing everyone's interested in college football, and we still get heckled. So, but here's the thing. LSU lost. Florida struggled against UMass. Ole Miss blew a lead. Tennessee needed overtime against Appalachian State. Mississippi State lost at home despite being favored by 28 points. Sharon, you guys at ESPN Stats and Info said that the SEC was like far and above the best conference in the league, and now here they are, a mess the first week. Should Kate, since she hates the SEC clearly, be reveling in their despair?
There's a lot of reveling going on after this weekend, I'll tell you that. I think it's a little early to make any quick judgments. That's the same conference that went 9-2 in bowls and just blew everybody out. They certainly were disappointing this weekend, but a bunch of the games they weren't supposed to win. So a lot of people are just looking at their win-loss record, but you got to look at how they did compared to what you expected them to do. Missouri wasn't supposed to beat West Virginia. Some of the games were supposed to be close. So they definitely, our number seven, they failed to meet expectations and about 2 wins fewer than expected. But maybe it's not as bad as everyone's making out to be.
So last question for you, Sharon, is about the playoff picture, which we already talked about the playoff committee a bit. But as I was thinking through the first week of college football, it brought to mind a lot of conversations that we have around here around early season developments in baseball, for example, or in the NBA, in which Neil very soberly cautions us that we need to wait for a third of the season to go by before we actually derive any insight about how good a team is. But to Kate's point earlier about the stakes being so high, there isn't time to wait in college football for the true talent of the team to manifest, because a loss early going for Oklahoma, for example, can have really significant effects on its playoff chances. And so I'm wondering sort of what are we supposed to make about the first week's results about how good a team is or how not good a team is? Because Oklahoma's playoff picture takes a hit, right? But maybe if they win the Big 12, they can still sneak in, for example. But does an early season loss mean they aren't good? Or does it just mean, like it does in baseball, that maybe they had a bad week?
With Oklahoma, they definitely still have a chance for the playoff. I'm convinced that a 2-loss team is going to make the playoff this year just because of how many good teams lost in week one. But with all the teams that lost or played bad, obviously they have some things to fix. But I don't think any team's out of it right now. I don't think any conference is out of it right now. The Big 12 might be a little worried after Oklahoma lost and TCU struggled against an FCS opponent. But
Texas is the salvation.
Yeah, there's a lot of football we played.
Okay, Sharon Katz from ESPN Stats Info, thanks for swinging by Hot Takedown for your Hot Takedown debut to talk about college football.
Thanks for having me.
Before we hear who Blythe Terrell's favorite NFL team should be, the result of Neil's investigation, we have one more word from a different sponsor. Hot Takedown is also sponsored this week by DraftKings. Football season is finally here, and it's time to put your fantasy knowledge to the test to win your share of $100,000 in DraftKings' free week one contest. That's right, $100,000 in a free contest this weekend on DraftKings. DraftKings.com is the destination for 1 week fantasy football all season long. 1 week fantasy means there is no season long commitment. You can play whenever you want with the players you want, people from the office, family members, total strangers. It's your call. Or you can try 50-50 contests where the top half of all entries win cash. DraftKings even has contests that are exclusively for beginners. There is something for everyone at DraftKings. So hurry to DraftKings.com now, and while you're there, use code TAKEDOWN to play for free in this weekend's $100,000 fantasy contest. Again, that's code TAKEDOWN to play for free for your share of $100,000 this weekend only at DraftKings.com. Eligibility restrictions may apply. See the website DraftKings.com for details. Okay, let's return to the NFL and return to Blythe Terrell's saga. Blythe Terrell with us in the studio, 538 Senior Editor. Hello, Blythe.
Hey, Chad. Hey, Neil. Hey, Kate.
Hey.
So Hi. To recap, listeners who didn't listen to last week's episode or have forgotten Blythe's sad tale, knocked on Neil's door. The rain was going. Trench coats were being worn. Neil, feet up on the desk with a cigarette. And Blythe said, Neil, I need your help. I need a new NFL team.
It was exactly,
Like that.
How it
happened.
Yeah.
Blythe, do you want to run us through why you need a new NFL team?
Why do I need a new team? Right. So I was / am a St. Louis Rams fan, and my team is gone. The owner took them away to Los Angeles. Back to Los Angeles, I will acknowledge. and now I don't know what to do. So I said, you know, I don't want to just cheer for no team this year. You know, I want to have somebody that I can actually get behind, but also I want to think about that in a sort of intelligent way. And I want to have a team that has ownership that I respect. And I want to have a team that, you know, is full of players that I can respect. And so I really wanted to get a sense of what the data said the ideal team for me would be. So I had to go to Neil because I do not have the skill set myself.
So, not that I necessarily do have the skill set, but I tried.
So, Neil, how did you try and address this question? Before we get to the reveal, you know, how do you solve a problem like a teamless fan?
Yeah, so once we decided we were going to do it according to the data, it kind of came down to figuring out, first of all, what are the factors that we should consider in becoming a fan of a team and putting a number on those, and then figuring out also how important those are to Blythe, mm-hmm. and kind of, you know, knowing how much weight to put on each particular category. So what I did was, first of all, I cooked up a 0 to 100 rating for each team in 16 different categories that ranged from the coach, the stadium experience, and some of these, a little less than half of these are taken from ESPN the magazine's what they call the ultimate standings, which is where they try to kind of also do a similar exercise to figure out, like, you know, which teams give you sort of the best bang for your buck and are most pleasant to be a fan of. So a lot of overlap with our exercise here. So I took some of the data from that. Also cooked up some of my own data points, including the bandwagon index, which is trying to figure out which teams have the highest odds of their next 5 years being better than their previous 5 years. And we also used data on player suspensions and specifically, you know, giving extra weight to ones that came for violence against women, because we don't want, you know, to credit a team for having people that, you know, kind of are not of high character, especially in that particular regard. So Once I already had all of that down, I asked Blythe to go to there's a website we used called allourideas.org, which allows you to kind of create a survey with a bunch of options and then pick just a continuous series of which one of these do you think is more important in your fan experience, player likability or ownership, future wins or tradition. And after Blythe, how many votes did you cast?
Like 3,300, I think. Yeah. I wanted to be completed about this.
Yes.
Yeah, seriously.
You clicked 3,300?
Yeah. You guys, I'm not messing around.
The number. Yeah, it tracks the number.
For something so serious,
there was enough variation in the questions, 3,300 times?
No, I mean, they give you the same questions over and over again, but also sometimes, you know,
you'll get different combinations.
Yeah,
have you just been taking the survey since the last time we spoke to you?
Yes, I have not showered.
Okay, so Neil, I think we should fast forward to the winners now that we know.
Well, first we should say what the most important categories were. Okay. I don't know if you have heard these yet, Blythe, right?
I glanced.
Oh, you didn't know because it was intuiting from
the kind of intuits from your answers of these two things to pick from. So number one was player behavior, which is the suspensions with the domestic violence demerit on top of them. That one got about twice as much weight as the average category. Then ownership. Big surprise for the Rams Rams fan.
Take that, Stan Kroenke.
Yes, that one got about 1.9 times as much weight. Player likability and effort on the field got 1.7 weight compared to the average factor. And then future wins, which is projected wins over the next five seasons, got 1.6 weight. So those were the far and away the four most important factors. But then also came bandwagon factor, tradition, bang for the buck, fan relations, and so forth.
Okay, though I just want to know if we valued like proximity, geographic location.
Yes, there were categories
human connection,
for
like the really most important.
There were there was a category for fan relations, which described courtesy by the players, coaches, and front offices toward the fans, with an emphasis on how they use the internet to reach out to fans. I also had factors for proximity to New York City, proximity to Blythe's hometown of St. Louis, uniform design from our friend Paul Lucas at UniWatch. I had a category for stadium experience, small market.
Neil.
Yeah. So many factors were considered.
You're filibustering.
So you were
what are the top five?
Okay. So coming in, first of all, for you, Kate, at number 17, the New York Giants.
That's because of Josh Brown.
Josh Brown not help them, but they also scored lower on player likability, future wins.
Sorry about that.
You know, bang
for
the buck.
What about proximity? That should have been weighted like
proximity
five times
anything else. Was rated very highly, but remember, they're not very proximate to St. Louis either. And so those
two
were kind of
close. So you're saying the Jets beat the Giants?
No, the Jets were actually much lower, coming in at number 30.
Wow. Oh, sorry, Jets.
Yeah,
okay. I will not be going to games with either of you this year, I guess. That's
sorry.
Yeah, you locked out on those free tickets from Kate, those season tickets.
I know.
How heavily did that get weighted, Neil, the free ticket offer?
Well, you know, we didn't have sufficient sample
17?
Size for that.
That
so,
really,
I'm
amazing.
Logging off.
All right. So at number five... we could get like a drum roll.
Yeah, jokes. Hear that drum roll in the studio.
Coming in at number five were the Buffalo Bills. They rated above average in all of the categories that you found most important, but they didn't rate as great in any of them, and so they kind of get that solid fifth ranking, but can't really break through that. Yeah, exactly. at number four, we have the New England Patriots.
Oh, that was close, you guys. That's too
close. Yes, it was a little too close.
My biggest fear is the Patriots.
So obviously their bandwagon rating was zero out of 100. They were the most bandwagon-y team possible. Actually scored pretty high on low rates of suspensions for the players. You know, pretty good.
Is that because most of them just go to jail?
Wow, Kate. The ownership was rated above average. They also had likable players, according to this.
Yeah.
And high future wins index. Okay. So at number three, the Kansas City Chiefs, which was a team
too.
That I thought would actually be, might be your number one contender.
Your husband is from Kansas City, so he roots for the Chiefs. Would you be willing to join him, or were you looking for a little bit of oppositional force? Because that can be an issue.
So it's interesting because my husband and I actually have no teams in common at all. So I kind of enjoy the tension in the household a little bit. It's like, Cardinals, Royals, Kansas, Missouri. We have this, you know, this state thing happening already. So I wouldn't have minded cheering for the Chiefs, but I also don't mind that the number one is going to be somebody different.
Okay. Yeah, and the Chiefs, unfortunately, they might have contended for number one if it weren't for the suspensions and violence category, where they were below average in that. At number two, we have the Pittsburgh Steelers.
Proud franchise.
Which was a proud franchise. You actually rated tradition higher than I thought you would, and probably higher than maybe you thought you would, because that was your sixth most important category, which I didn't get the sense from you when we were talking beforehand that you would have rated team tradition that high. So, but the Steelers rate high in that category.
But Roethlisberger,
Of course, if I could alternate the methodology, perhaps I would have put more weight on the high profileness of the players. As it is, I just had counts of.
You
didn't
weight it by approximate value.
I know, right? I should have weighted it by
Come
approximate
on.
Value.
Like, if a kicker was the one with the interaction, right? Exactly.
Kate.
Okay, so before we get to number one,
yes,
I believe we have.
You guys should guess also.
True.
Who
yeah,
do you think?
Okay, so,
is
the Los Angeles
one.
Rams.
Oh my God!
Ownership.
It can't be the Cowboys.
I mean,
it's Greg
Hardy.
Because
like,
I'm thinking about that tradition thing, right?
And yeah.
So, Blythe, go ahead.
Well,
the Saints.
My suspicion is that it's going to be the Packers because of ownership and tradition, possibly also.
Yeah.
That's my guess.
Likeability of players.
Right.
Yeah.
Chad, what's your guess?
The Packers is a very good one. The bandwagon thing is what's playing in my mind about the Packers. The Packers are already good.
Right.
And they're not going to
get
that's low.
Yeah.
Suggesting, I'm thinking around the league, the Bengals? No.
I'm thinking
the Seahawks?
The
we haven't talked about the Seahawks.
So
I think
the Seahawks ranked seventh.
Okay. Whew, that's another one, you guys.
All right, so
that's another relief.
All right, Kate, any last guesses before we do the drum roll?
I can't. The 49ers?
Oh, interesting. The bandwagon index would be very high given how much they've created. And did you factor in anthem protests? All right. So let's do that drum roll.
Okay. Drum roll, please, for the number one. Give me the envelope. I'll blow in it. And the winner is the Green Bay Packers.
Oh!
You guys nailed it. The Packers. The Packers rated really high in a low number of player suspensions. They were number one in ownership with 100 out of 100. They were 97 out of 100 in player likability.
Wow.
77 out of 100 in future wins. Their bandwagon factor was low. It was 6 out of 100, but they had the number one tradition rating. They were 81 out of 100 in terms of bang for the buck if you want to actually go to a Packer
game. I would
not
mind.
At Lambeau Field, their fan relations were 100 out of 100. Their proximity to New York was only 52 out of 100, but their proximity to St. Louis was 84 out of 100. They also had 94 out of 100 in affordability, 100 out of 100 in small market, which you rated higher as a preference above big market, even though it wasn't a big preference, 100 out of 100 stadium experience, high coaching, 81 out of 100, and even a 94 out of 100 uniform. So the Green Bay Packers are your team for
All
the
right.
2016 NFL
it.
Season.
I'll take it. Thank you very much, Neil. I'm so glad you were here to solve this mystery.
Not
really a mystery.
Well,
are you willing to root
is.
For the Packers?
Am I willing to root for the Packers? Yeah, I'll definitely root for the Packers. I feel like as I was going through the survey and as we were talking about it, I mean, the Packers were on my mind a little bit, not intentionally, but I was just thinking, I was trying to think of the teams that I thought were best at the things I cared about, and that was the team that kept popping into my head without having looked at the data. So it's very interesting that that's what they ended up
you
being.
You knew, you kind of intuited what the data would say.
It was in your heart all along.
I'm excited for the next time you're at a cocktail party and somebody's like, well, who's your football team? And you're like, the Packers. And they're like, how did that happen?
Like, how much time you
you're
got?
Like, yeah.
Do I have a 3,300-click survey for you? All right.
No, that's awesome. Well, thank you so much, Neil.
Sure.
This has been a really
satisfied
fun experience.
Customer.
Of
That's
course.
Right.
And
sorry, Kate.
Recommend to all your friends.
Right. We will be posting an accompanying article about your experience on Thursday, I think it is. And in conjunction with that, I'll be putting the scores of the teams up on GitHub, and I'll put out a link to other people who want to kind of reconstruct their own
people
survey
their own.
Using the
Love
same
it.
Method.
Love it.
Awesome. Sounds
all right.
Cool.
Blythe, glad we could solve this for you.
Thanks. Thanks for letting me on the show, everybody. I appreciate it.
Hot takedown saves
Bye,
another
Blythe.
Fan.
Bye, Kate.
Okay, now to close out the show, our significant digit, when a telling number from the world of sports comes to us, is delivered to us often in the guise of Neil Payne. Hello, Neil.
Hey, Chad.
Neil, what do you have for us this week?
So our sig dig comes from a story that I wrote a week ago where I looked at basically – you can kind of reconstruct if teams held on to the original players. This is Major League Baseball teams held on to the original players that they had, and they didn't get rid of those players. You can use wins above replacement to figure out how good each team would be, kind of in this hypothetical universe where they held on to all of their original talent. So it's kind of a quantification of how good the teams are at kind of drafting and signing international prospects. And then also, if you compare that hypothetical to what actually has happened, you can kind of see how good they've been at, or bad they've been in some cases, at sort of making shrewd decisions.
Right, the general manager
grabbing.
So, okay,
the talent.
This is hypothetical baseball, one of 538's favorite pastimes to engage in, one I have mixed feelings about.
Isn't all baseball hypothetical, really?
Ooh.
Well, Kate.
Throwing those bombs about baseball. You haven't done that in a while, Kate.
I told you I was going to come in with some snark.
It's true. So, Neil, what was the big, you know, what's the major sort of team that's done really well compared to their drafts?
Right. So the Sig Dig is 15. That's the number of wins of difference between what the Washington Nationals record would be. If they had held on to their players, they'd only have 63 wins. But as it is, and this is as of last Friday, so they probably won a few more since then. But then they had 78 wins. So that difference is 15 wins.
Daniel Murphy?
And Daniel Murphy himself makes up a pretty decent chunk of them. I think he has about five WAR or some such this season, and so maybe six. So a big chunk of them are Murphy, and that's probably why the Mets also, in their hypothetical universe, would be better than they would be otherwise. But also, you know, the Blue Jays are number two. They are 12 wins better than they would be with their original talent. Meanwhile, at the other end of the spectrum, you have the Braves, you have the Reds, you have the Los Angeles Angels. Certainly the Braves and Reds are two teams that sort of have intentionally done this. They've jettisoned all of their talent that they can. You think of Aroldis Chapman and people like that to try to bottom out and tank in the manner of the Houston Astros of a couple of years ago. So that's deliberate. The Angels just can't put anyone good around Mike Trout, I think, and they've been one of the more disappointing teams. So there's different flavors of it, but it does kind of speak to organizational priorities. The Nationals and Jays, and to a lesser extent, the Giants have kind of gone out and gotten talent and kind of bolstered their roster aggressively, and the Reds and Braves have de-bolstered their roster.
So, Neil, what this tells me, yet again, is that the Mets are not good.
No, I mean, it's not necessarily
good,
that.
They chose not to.
They could be better than they are.
Yeah, surprise, surprise.
But
all right,
they're still in it.
Let's bring the show home before you bring me any more bad news. Kate Fagan, thanks so much for chatting about sports.
Thanks, Chad.
We hope to see you again soon when you're liberated from your Bristol
cage.
When
I'm back in the Big Apple.
Yeah. Neil Payne.
Thanks,
always
Chad.
A pleasure. Always
course,
a pleasure talking
to you. Of course.
Our podcast producer is Joe Sykes. Our podcast general manager is Jody Avergan. We got production assistance from Tony Chow, Jorge Estrada, and Jonathan Yales this week. You can email us at podcasts@538.com. We would love to hear what you think. You can find us on your favorite podcasting app or on iTunes. You can subscribe at itunes.com/538, all spelled out. Be sure while you're there to review and or rate the show. It helps others discover the program. And remember to keep an eye out for Baseline in your hot takedown feed. Our global tennis senior editor, correspondent, Carl Bialik. Tennis podcast. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. I am Chadwick Matlin. Talk to you next time.